The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your biweekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined this week by Evan Burnick of the Center for Judicial Engagement, as well as special guest, Ricard Poach Kanawala. This week on the show, due process on campus, hunting trophies, drug forfeiture, and qualified immunity for killing dogs. Ricard, kick us off.
So, in John Doe 1 and 2 versus the University of Cincinnati, Doe 1 and 2 were students at the school, and they were accused in unrelated incidents of sexual assaults by fellow students. Following internal university discipline hearings, Doe 1 and 2 were both found responsible of the allegations. They appealed within the internal discipline process, and new hearings were held. They were found responsible again. Doe 1 was suspended for 3 years, and Doe 2 was put on academic disciplinary probation. So they then sued the university officials for denial of 14th Amendment due process, and the defendants bring a motion to dismiss, which the trial court grants. So the issue here is, did the accused actually receive their due process rights within the internal university process?
So the Does alleged that there were systematic deficiencies in the way that the university went about collecting evidence, interviewing witnesses, and ultimately adjudicating, if you can even call it that, these particular cases. In conformance to a 2011 Dear Colleague letter sent by the Department of Education concerning Title IX and how to interpret Title IX in the context of sexual assault, universities have been scrambling to try to find ways to deal with something that is ultimately a criminal offense that belongs in courts of justice, not administrative tribunals. And courts have been evaluating these for conformance to a loosey-goosey due process standard articulated by the Supreme Court in a case involving Social Security benefits from decades ago. The result is predictable. Universities do not provide anything resembling due process of law. You have, in this particular case, individuals who point out that witnesses were not that could have disputed the accused stories were not talked to. Evidence that was collected by University of Police was not looked into by the tribunals. Police who could have testified on behalf of this of the accused were not allowed to participate. Attorneys were not allowed to actually assist, but just were able to be present, and you couldn't actually impeach the witness except by asking and submitting written questions as opposed to confronting them at the moment.
Ricard.
There's also an issue with the court relying on procedural protections that the respondents received in their first hearing within the internal discipline process that they said had issues. But the court says we don't have to worry about that because they got a second hearing. But then the court goes back to that very first hearing to say, well, John Doe 2 was allowed to cross-examine the complainant in that first hearing, so we don't really have to worry about the fact that he didn't get to do so in the second. So which is it?
Right. And there's all kinds of stuff you could mention. Hearsay is allowed. The panels that are making these decisions hear impact statements by the victims denouncing the accused prior to the quote-unquote adjudication of responsibility. And the reviewing court, the Sixth Circuit, basically says, well, you know, universities have to be able to structure their procedures in a way that's cost effective, and we can't have everything. We can't have things spanned out for too long a period of time. So it's totally okay to have these witnesses saying that these individuals should go to hell right before decisions are made.
And the problem that the court starts to recognize and then backs away from is that the victim impact statement before a finding is made affects the credibility of can affect the credibility of the witness, of the complainant. That can boost the credibility in the eyes of the panel. So it's not just the prejudice of making the statement. It's also that statement could go to the credibility of the complainant.
Evan, you mentioned Title IX earlier. Can you just explain what that is really quick?
I mean, there's a whole apparatus in place that is designed to ensure that universities conform to Title IX. You have to have a campus Title IX coordinator who visits you and presents you with the fact that this person is accusing you of something. You have a group of administrators who later, quote-unquote, adjudicates your responsibility. All of these officials are hired by the university. Most of them are hired by the university for the purposes of ensuring compliance with federal law. They are not people who are necessarily have any experience in what is ultimately an essentially criminal context. And you don't have people who are law enforcement professionals or veterans of the courts that are involved in the first place. No people essentially who would know anything about what due process of law traditionally looks like in courts of justice.
So Title IX is a federal law.
Yeah, it was enacted decades ago. It's a federal law that's designed ultimately to prevent sex discrimination and to, relevant to this particular context, ensure that universities prevent sexual assault on campus. There was an interpretive letter that probably should have been passed through notice and comment procedures because it ultimately transformed the way that Title IX operates, that was sent to universities in 2011 with the implicit suggestion that if you do not comply with this letter, we will withdraw federal funds for you. Universities snapped in line. They have acted on the basis of a ambiguous definition of sexual assault, and they put all these procedures in place that are designed to combat what is perceived to be a huge problem with sexual assaults on campus. The problem is that you have individuals and officials who are just fundamentally not capable, either structurally or in terms of their personal competence, of adjudicating cases like this. It should be outside of the universities and should be inside of the courts.
And everyone recognizes that these are serious allegations. The court itself speaks to the high private interests that the respondents have in these cases and their reputational interests, liberty and property interests. So,
right. I mean, the stakes are incredibly high, both for the victim and for the alleged victim and for the accused. And you need an apparatus and you need personnel that are structurally and professionally equipped to handle that. And universities just don't have it. So there are a couple of things going on with this. Go ahead.
Ricard, this is a non-precedential decision. What does that mean?
Well, essentially, it means that you can't rely on this decision in a future case, which always speaks to the question of what was going on here that the court doesn't want it to be relied on in the future.
Doesn't it usually indicate that?
It means that it is, for all intents and purposes, a mundane decision that breaks no novel or striking grounds in the direction of the law.
In the
court's settled view. Application of Matthews, nothing to see here, move on. And that's that's one of the many things that are troubling about the decision.
What else is troubling?
There are a couple of other things that are troubling. I mean, you could go back to Matthews and this loosey-goosey due process inquiry, or you can focus on that even given the reality of Matthews, it should be applied in a context, fact-sensitive way. And you need an engaged judiciary to even do the best that you can with what I think was a deficient decision. And the court did not do that.
Okay, let's move on to the next case, which comes out of the D.C. Circuit. Evan?
Yeah, this is an interesting case that involves an attempt by a couple of groups that want to go hunting for elephants in Tanzania to acquire permits for that purpose from the Department of the Interior, from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Department of Fish and Wildlife is charged with ensuring that the United States complies with a convention that is designed to protect potentially threatened species. And in order to get permits to hunt threatened species and repatriate them, that is, bring them back into America, you need to secure their permission. In 2014, they came to the conclusion, going against longstanding precedent with respect to hunting elephants in Tanzania, that hunters could not go to Tanzania and they could not repatriate their animals if they hunted and killed them because there would be too much of a detriment to the worldwide presence of elephants, and there wouldn't be an offsetting benefit from if you pay to hunt someplace, perhaps the host country can support conservation efforts, and that would be good. That didn't happen here. Bottom line is they were prevented from hunting. They couldn't get permits. They want to challenge those actions, and the agency is giving them the runaround.
So they sue the agency, and what happens next, Ricard?
they sue the agency, and the agency brings a motion to dismiss, saying that, in essence, that they didn't apply for permits in the first place. And that should be the reason that, the case is dismissed and sent back. And the problem with that, of course, which the court recognizes here, is that it's it would be an entirely futile and waste of time endeavor to apply for permits where the agency, the service, has already said, we've got a blanket ban on import permits for the year in question.
Right. I mean, you just have to make your way through some of these arguments to believe how absurd they are. In response to the fact that, yes, they have made this ruling specifically determining that this is a threatened species and you can't go and hunt it and we're not going to give you permits, you nonetheless need to apply for a permit that you know will be denied. Otherwise, you haven't, you don't have standing to challenge it. And their response to this, or the response to the claim that that's absurd on the part of the agency, is, well, you know, we could hypothetically change our minds. Or maybe they wouldn't have actually been successful in hunting elephants and they wouldn't have caught them anyway. So you have a host of alternative arguments that are brought up to deny the ability of these people to challenge the denial of these permits. And, I mean, that's just the first step. We have the standing argument. Then we get into the argument that, well, it's not really a final agency action because we could ultimately reach a different determination. Finally, well, this doesn't really matter because this was years ago, and so the case is moot. And finally, it goes on and on and on. And the court, to its credit, sees through this, sees that the agency is giving these people the runaround, sees that if it accepts those arguments, you wouldn't be able to challenge these determinations at all, and comes to the correct engaged result, which is that, yes, they can go forward with their claims.
Okay, let's move on to the next case, Ricard.
So this case involves a defendant who's an employee at his brother's hardware store. The brother and the defendant are both convicted of selling an iodine-based water purifier that can be used to manufacture methamphetamines. The defendant appeals his conviction on the merits, and the government appeals on the issue of whether the defendant should forfeit the remaining store profit that was made from the sales of the water purifier with the iodine chemical in it. And so the real issue here is whether a store employee, the defendant, who's convicted of selling or conspiracy to sell a product that includes a List 1 chemical, can be jointly and severally liable under the criminal statute to forfeit all profit that the store made from its sales off that product.
So we should make a point. Joint and several liability is something that people most normally encounter in the context of civil cases, tort actions. And what it's designed to do is to ensure that somebody is compensated when a couple of individuals, or maybe more than a couple of individuals, arguably might have been responsible for the underlying injury. So it's a civil law concept, and the question is whether, well, it's already migrated into criminal law in the context of conspiracy actions. We see that here. The question is whether it's also going to move into criminal forfeiture. And there's actually a circuit split on this. And this is what the issue that the court is ultimately going to take up is whether an individual like it was Joseph or Matthew is the individual who is
Terry, I think.
Terry, okay. Terry, who is a salaried employee, who therefore has not obtained anything in particular in respect of profits from his participation in this criminal enterprise, is nonetheless subject to the forfeiture of these proceeds because he participated in a conspiracy to violate the law. That's the underlying question.
The government wants to forfeit $70,000. It's from him, even though he never touched the proceeds. So,
right.
Who has the $70,000?
Interestingly, the government actually makes the argument that because he might have physically touched some of the money, he obtained it in some way. But ultimately, yes, he has never benefited from this directly in terms of money he has acquired because he's a salaried employee. His brother, on the other hand, did, and he's already, in the context of his plea deal, paid $200,000 worth of the $270,000. The government is now trying to get $70,000 from this other guy, despite the fact that he actually has not obtained anything.
We should also point out that the $70,000 does not come from illegal sales. These were sales of the product that were legitimate. And the trial court found, and the court on appeal repeated, that the business itself was perfectly legitimate. So the sales are the legitimate sales of the product is really what the government's going after here. And a question has to be raised about that. Why should the government be after proceeds of legitimate sales?
Right. The tricky thing about this, and this is why these guys ultimately end up getting into trouble, is they began selling this stuff. They became aware that shady-looking individuals were hanging around the store. They actually went to the Chattanooga police and said, hey, is there any connection between this iodine cleansing product and illegal activity? They were told yes, and then they proceeded to continue to sell it to these shady-looking people on a kind of don't ask, don't tell basis. These individuals would approach the counter, they would sell directly to them, and they eventually ended up selling to undercover cops. So even though, like, all of the activity itself is legal, their knowing participation in what they broadly knew was drug activity is ultimately what gets them into trouble. And so the question is, are we going to take that one step further? Not only have they been convicted, are we going to take away what is ultimately the product of sales that in themselves are completely legal on the basis of the fact that ultimately they knew that they were ultimately going to illegal activities?
And the knowing element of that certainly goes to the conviction on the merits, which the government obtained at trial, and that was affirmed here. So that part of it, I think, is settled. What really is the problem is what we've identified here: the government going after, trying to get forfeiture of sale proceeds from perfectly legitimate sales, even though they may have been connected to other sales that were illegitimate.
Right. And the other component, and I think this is ultimately what the Supreme Court is really interested in, is the statute says obtained. Obtained is something that refers to something that accrues to an individual. The idea that you can obtain something that somebody else only benefits from and you gain nothing from doesn't make any sense. The D.C. Circuit actually reached that conclusion in one case, but several other circuits have gone in a different direction. So the hope is that the court will pay attention to the actual language of the statute, recognize that this guy never obtained anything, as the district court did, and we'll get an engaged decision by the Supreme Court. We'll see.
Absolutely. And reading it to say that indirectly covers this, indirectly in the statute covers this context, really obliterates the word obtained out of the law. And that's really what the D.C. Circuit focused on, and hopefully what will form the basis of argument at the Supreme Court.
Right. Because, I mean, if you can indirectly obtain something. If I receive something and then I give it to somebody else, they have indirectly obtained it. But if you never gain anything from me, or if I never gain anything from you, then I haven't indirectly obtained I haven't obtained anything at all.
Okay, let's move on to the final case, which also comes out of the Sixth Circuit. Evan?
Yeah, so this case comes out of the Sixth Circuit and involves the execution of a search warrant on a house where a very dangerous person might be staying. The police do a trash pull of a woman's house. They find evidence that a known drug dealer who has not only been involved in violence, but has violent associates, might be staying there. And they get a warrant, and they arrive to do a search of the house. They encounter somebody who is taking care of a couple of dogs who happen to live in this house. They didn't know that dogs were there originally. They are told about the presence of dogs in this house. One of the officers is. Then a different team of officers shows up. There's some dispute. They might not have been told whether there are dogs in this house. Anyway, they go in. They search the house, and they encounter one dog immediately. They shoot and kill that dog. They go down into the basement, and they shoot and kill another dog. And the question is whether they acted reasonably in killing these two dogs. There's a Fourth Amendment claim, given that dogs are, if they are the property, they fall within the scope of effects under the Fourth Amendment. And there's a suit that's being brought against these officers for their for an unreasonable seizure of effects.
So all this takes place in a backdrop where, according to police officers in this department, Officers brag about killing dogs, how often they do it, and they even put stickers on their lockers in a way of to tally their kills. So that's kind of the environment in which this is taking place. What does the court make of that, Ricard?
The court, unfortunately, doesn't make too much of it. They come to
not model police behavior. They say
absolutely. They come to the conclusion that it's a reasonable seizure, that the shooting and killing of both dogs, and then say that there has been no constitutional violation here. And even though that police behavior of tallying other dog kills isn't model behavior, that there's no city or municipal liability because they didn't necessarily know about or facilitate that kind of behavior. But I think there are problems with this case from top to bottom.
Yeah, so let's focus on some of those problems. When the police arrive at the scene, they encounter a guy. His name is Mike Brown, right? Who is taking care of the dogs and informs them that, yes, the dogs are in the house, and also says that one of the dogs has never barked at anyone in his life. It's a friendly dog. The police go in, and they claim that this dog that's been said never to have barked in its life lunges at them, and the police respond to this by shooting the dog.
Lunges and barks at them
and shoots them. And the court says, well, you know, there's nothing necessarily inconsistent about those two things. The dog could have been a, you know, friendly dog that never barked a day in its life, and it still could have, you know, immediately lunged and attacked these police as they showed up. And the court says, well, actually, what the officers said with respect to what the dog did is unrebutted testimony. There seems to be an inconsistency there, but the court just kind of brushes it off. And with respect to the other dog, they just take the police officer's words at face value. They went into the basement. There was a dog. It looked dangerous. Therefore, they shot it. Perfectly reasonable. Obviously, you have problems where the only witnesses to this whole thing are the police and, well, the dogs. And it's difficult for reviewing courts to look back at that and say, hey, the police should have done something differently. But the lack of skepticism, particularly in a context in which you have an environment in which people are keeping tallies of the dogs they killed, really is striking.
And on top of that, even the officer testimony is problematic. The dog only lunged inches, according to the officer, before the officer shot and killed the dog. That surely cannot entail an imminent and serious physical danger. If the dog is merely moved a few inches after the officers have broken down the front door of the house where the dogs lived, that seems to be a huge overreaction at most.
Right. And that's just the first dog. When they get down to the second dog really isn't doing anything. They just say that, well, we couldn't safely clear the basement as long as the dog's there. Okay, then we can shoot the dog. So, again, it really is a striking example of, you know, I would say is, despite the fact that, yes, they're the only witnesses, yes, it's difficult to second-guess police officers in dangerous situations, it does appear to be an example of judicial abdication.
I'd absolutely agree with that. And the court didn't have to get into this. They could simply have dismissed the summary judgment motion and let the case go ahead and see what the facts came out and how a jury found those facts.
Right. I mean, about the only thing that the court did right is that police officers sought qualified immunity. And the court said, look, circuits have been over this. We agree that a dog is property. To the extent that you have unreasonably seized that property by shooting it repeatedly, that's a constitutional claim. But then you have the abdication portion, which is, you know, just accepting the police officer's view of the facts and not even letting it go forward, go to a jury and get a serious fact-sensitive investigation.
Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for listening. And so until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, coaxing you to get engaged.